Jenny?
Sashi.
Uki Chukshin Metok Tran. Rira Ling Shin Yen De Gen Padi. Sangye Shing Du Mek Te Uwaki. Chokun Amdak Shing La Shupar Shuk. Iram Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niryatayami
Sangye
Chirang Soki Choknam La Changshu Vardu Rakni Kapsuchi Daki Shenyen Gipe Sunam Ki Trola Penshir Sangye Chuparshu
Sangye
Chirang Soki Choknam La
Changshu
Vardu Rakni Kyapsuchi Daki Chenyen Gipe Sunam Ki Chola Penshir Sangye Chuparshu
Sangye
Chirang Soki Choknam La Changshu Vardu Rakni Kyapsuchi Daki Chinyen Gipe Sunam Ki Chola Penchir Sangye Chupashu. And we'll go right into meditation. And sitting up nice and tall. Shoulders come up to the ears together, down the back. And then just start to let go of whatever your mind's grasping to. As you bring your focus to the crown of the head. And then slowly start to scan down your body. And spend extra time where there's more tension, giving it a moment to release. And if there's any thoughts or feelings that are calling for your attention, just letting them go. Creating space around them and bringing your focus to the physical body. We tend to think the feelings or thoughts that we have come up are so important or so meaningful. Especially when we're meditating. That we have to grasp on and follow them. And really, we can just choose to let them go. over and over, releasing whatever your mind grabs onto. And coming back to only the physical felt sensations in the body. And once you've scanned all the way down, and scan back up. You can pause wherever there's still tension, something that is going to take a little more time to release. And find your breath. It can be feeling the breath in the whole physical form. Maybe just at the belly. Chest or the tip of the nose, the nostrils. Pick wherever your mind feels open and spacious, where your focus is clear and bright. Not creating tension in the body. and remember your intention for practicing. And expand your field of awareness. Slowly throughout your whole body. And into the room around you. Start to move and open your eyes. On class 8. Yeah. And it's Wednesday, February 28th. So what is the text that we're studying? One of them.
Highway for Bodhisattvas.
Mm-hmm. And who is that one by? And what are his dates?
1857 to 1480.
And what is that text in Tibetan?
Jangchub Shung Lam.
Yes. Jangchub Shung Lam. And then the second text, the one that has the more succinct presentation of the vows. String of Shining Jewels by who?
Geshe Sewang Samdrup.
Yep. And then what's the Tibetan for that one?
Norbai Uchang.
Yep. Very good. Okay.
And on his dates, do we need to remember the dates of the 10th Dalai Lama, who he tutored, because we don't necessarily know his dates?
You could.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the dates of the 10th Lama. Do you?
It was in our notes.
Is it?
18...
somewhere in there. Yeah. It might be from the first class. Yeah. So we kind of already talked about this. Last week we ended up totally running out of time, and this week we have a lot of vows to go through too. We're going through vows 17 through 34. So I'm going to have to be conscious not to talk a lot about every vow. It doesn't seem like there's that much, but it didn't seem like it last week either. So,
you had a lot of questions last week.
So we kind of talked about this before, but we have vows in the form of a bapchak if we've taken them in past lives. But we haven't agreed to them yet in this life if we haven't taken them yet in this life. So once you agree to them again and take them again, then you'll be responsible for them. So we kind of already went over this question before. Okay, so let's start with vow number 17. Okay, so well, let's just start with this. So number 17, say Shila Le Lendu Shila Sok Ji Jong Gi Chi Shi. That one's hard. Shila Le Lendu Shila Sok Ji Jong Gi Chi Shi. Yes. Okay. So this one is in answer to being yelled at, you yell back, etc. Okay, so if you don't yell back, you follow the first point of the four points of virtue, which we'll go over. And we've talked about this before too, but the first time you hear these, they're going to be fresh and you'll want to keep them and practice them. So jump on it right away and practice it right away. Because the next time you hear it, it's not going to be as exciting. It's just how it goes. You know, like when we've heard it once, then the next time we hear it, we're kind of like, oh, we've heard this. So the four points of virtue, in the vow, they only mention the first one. And then the et cetera means that there's three more. So the vow is the first one, which is someone yells at you and you don't respond in kind. So these are four things that you want to do. Breaking any of these four, you'll break this vow. And in the vow cards that I have, they're separated out by these four. So it's not just all one vow, so you can track them kind of separately.
What are the vow cards?
Well, somebody put together vow cards for me when I took my Bodhisattva vows, and then I put together some, and I think I gave them to Jay when he took his, but I'll have them for you guys too, so you'll be able to have like little cards that you can fill your book out with each day. So they're all separated out in there. So the first one is this vow. Someone yells at you and you don't respond in kind, which is really difficult. For me, this mostly comes up with a partner. Like, it doesn't come up for me with family members or anyone at work or, you know, much like that. For me, it's mostly with partners. So you probably know where your place is, where it happens, and then you just be super careful in that area. So it's like whenever you go into a situation that where you know it triggers you or possibly, then you're just really careful when you go into that situation and you plan ahead and you think and imagine, okay, this has happened before. If it happens this time, this is what I'm going to do. So you can do meditations or just picture it in your mind, and it helps you be able to do that in the situation. It works. I think it works really well. It's super helpful. And it's very, very, this is very difficult because our immediate reaction if someone yells at us is to yell back. That's immediately what we want to do. And then the second one, say Trupa La Larmi Trowa.
Trupa La Larmi Trowa.
So someone has gotten angry at you and put you down and you don't respond in kind, which is automatically what we want to do. Is someone says, you did this, and immediately we want to say, well, you did that too. Just automatically, that's what comes up. So practicing and keeping these in mind through our book helps us to not do these things. And I see this tendency all the time in myself, with Mike, all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says, like, you did this, and immediately I want to say, well, you did that too, and in fact, you do it all the time, or, you know, something like that. So that's like our deep habit, I think. So we break our bodhisattva vow if we do this. And there are extenuating circumstances, which we'll get to. And then the third one, say, Dekpa La Lar Sang Mi Dekpa.
Dekpa La Lar Sang Mi Dekpa.
Someone hits you and you don't respond in kind. I don't know. For me, this one is, I've only really seen this, like, if someone, like, kind of like pushes me or does something or like smacks my arm or something like that. Because I've never really been in the situation where I've been hit by someone. My sense is if I was hit by someone, I don't think I would respond in kind. I think I'd just like start crying or something, but I don't know. So different people have different tendencies, and I guess what I think of is, like, when you see people in, like, a real fight, then that's maybe where that comes up. Mm-hmm. So maybe, yeah. Yeah, when your kids? Yeah.
Or, like, with your kid, like, if your kid is smacking you, and, like...
Oh, yeah. You like, that's their punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe hitting, but spanking, or...
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or I could see, though, and I don't know if this is what it's talking about, but, like, if somebody gets in front of you in traffic or, like, hits your car or something, I can see wanting to hit their car. Like, I've had thoughts of, you know, someone cuts me off, and I almost want to just, like, hit their car. So that's probably, you know, a concentric circle of that. And we can all think of what it would be like in our own lives. Okay. So you break the bodhisattva vow if you hit back. So all of these are basically turning the other cheek. Somebody does something to you, we're not like 3 years old anymore and we just do it back. Although that's what we all want to do mostly. So it's just like getting over that tendency. So it's not hitting back because of any other reason except that you know it's going to harm you in the future. I think, too, it's going to feel crappy in the moment, and then you're going to feel bad after, too. So the only one Geshe Michael says, though, is that it's going to harm you in the future. So out of an understanding of emptiness and of karma. And the other vow that we have, striking someone out of anger, that's different than this one because that one involves simmering anger. Like, you're stewing on something, and you're stewing and stewing and stewing, and it builds up so much to then you hit them. And this one's more immediate. It's just like they hit you, you hit them right back. That sort of thing with this one. And then the fourth one, say, Sang Dru La Lar Sang Mi Dru.
Sang Dru La Lar Sang Mi Dru.
Someone points out your faults, you don't respond in kind. I think this one's really hard. And again, I think of, this comes up for me all the time with Mike. If he points out something, immediately what my mind goes to is, you do that too. And, you know, sometimes I say it too. So if someone points out your faults, like, you were late, you don't say, well, you were late too the other day. You know, you just don't do that. So that would be breaking this vow.
If you were to say, would you just not say you, like, pointing it out to them, they do that too, but what if you were to point that out in a nice, kind way? Or would that
be... What would that look like?
Like, I feel like that hurts me because I feel like you do that too.
Or like,
maybe you can't really point it out. I don't think it's necessary to point it out, but you just want to. Like, my mind so goes there all the time. It's like, I want to point out, but then I do that too. Like, I know that I do it, and I'm like so wanting to, because it's always a mirror.
Yeah.
Always.
I think that, like, the flavor of these, to me, is more like you're getting back at someone. It's more about retaliation. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing it out of retaliation, then I'd say, even if you say it nicely, I don't think that flies. But if you're not, if you're just like, you're feeling, maybe if you're feeling hurt and you're just trying to explain why you're feeling hurt and that it has to do with that, that might be different. But I'd say probably just check your motivation in each situation, because I think most of the time it's like that knee-jerk, well, you do that, and just like pushing it off onto someone else. Or I know I have that all the time. I think most of the time, not all the time, but I think I notice it more with Mike now. I don't know about, it doesn't come up much at work right now, but it was for a lot for a while. And there was like a lot of gossip at work, and I thought I wasn't participating in it, but when I left, I realized that I had been. It was just, like, not as big as everyone else, so I didn't notice it. So I think I was kind of doing that then. Like, someone would say I did something wrong, and I'd say, well, they did this, or, you know, something like that. So it's basically... what Geshe Michael says about this is trying to advertise someone else's partly hidden faults to dig into their past and draw attention to their faults. So it's like when you have a friend or a family member or whoever, and you're constantly reminding them of something bad that they did in the past. I've done this for sure, too. Like... you know, they're pointing out something that someone did, and maybe they did something similar in the past. So it's hurtful to do that to someone. That's all. That's what these are all about, is that we're becoming bodhisattvas who are taking care of all beings and, you know, caring for them and not doing harmful things. So, I mean, I've had people do that to me, too, where they point out what I've done in the past, you know, like some hurtful thing that happens that is not a happy thing to be reminded of. So that's also in this one. You're not trying to dig up all of their dirt and remind them of it. Because it's really messed up to do that. And I've done that for sure. I think I've gotten a lot better about that one. Okay. 18, 19, and 20. Say Trupanamni.
Trupanamni.
Yelwarndor.
Yelwarndor.
Trupanamni Yelwarndor.
Trupanamni Yelwarndor.
Okay. Just ignoring people who are angry because of something you did to them or something that they think you did to them. So they're angry because you did something to them or because they think you did. And then you don't go and apologize or explain to them or anything. If they're angry at you, you have to go to them and apologize or explain that you didn't try to harm them so that they don't fester in their anger and it grows and it grows. So it's a kindness to do that. All of these are a kindness to the other person. They're also a kindness to yourself because they're planting a different seed than our habitual tendency. So you have to clear the air. The motivation would be pride, laziness, jealousy, hatred, something like that for not doing it. And it's easy to not want to do this. If somebody is mad at you because of something that you didn't do or something that you did do and maybe they misunderstood or maybe they didn't, but it's easy to just want to ignore them and not want to talk to them. That's the easy way. So being a bodhisattva and walking the whole path is not easy. And it's because most of our tendencies are completely wrong, so they're going against our natural tendencies to want to punish other people, try to get things for ourselves, which doesn't work the way we're doing it. It's the opposite of what we're doing. So that's what these are trying to get us to do. They're steering us towards the direction of enlightenment instead of towards more suffering, which is where we want to go. Even though, you know, we don't want to, but we really do in the moment when it comes up. We want to punish the person or we just are too lazy. We just don't care. Like they don't matter or something like that. The exceptions would be, which we would have to be a very high practitioner for this first one, to teach a lesson, to discredit a wrong spiritual teaching or some evil, if someone would get more angry if you brought it up again. Because I think at that point, it would mostly just be selfish to bring it up. If you know that they're going to get really angry if you talk to them about it again. Someone wouldn't be comfortable with the apology, or they wouldn't be helped by an apology. So it's good to remember the exceptions, too, because mostly we barely remember the vow, and then when we look back at it, we just take it literally and think that we have to do it no matter what. So it's good to go back and review these. Okay, say Parul Shekhi Chakpa Pung. Okay, not accepting an apology. So this one's different than the other one because it doesn't have the simmering anger. So, for example, you don't feel like accepting the apology or you feel superior to the person so you don't have to. Something like that. The exceptions are, again, to teach a lesson. The apology received is insincere or disrespectful. So it's the simmering anger and them refusing to reconcile. That's the root vow. But if you don't have the simmering anger, then it's the secondary vow, which is this one. So basically, you just have to accept people's apologies in general. It shouldn't be that hard, but it can be. It can be when it comes up. Especially if we're really angry or hurt by what somebody did. So basically here, you're lazy or you feel like you're better than them and you don't want to talk to them. Okay, So number 20, say Trupe Semki Jesu Juk. Okay. And this one is not to consider it wrong to be angry, not to try to counteract the anger, to let it flow, and even to enjoy the anger. Which we basically get the opposite message from just about everything in our society. That, you know, like every movie, people are going out for revenge and like killing all these people, and it's supposed to be just, and we just get the opposite message all the time, so it's easy to slip into this one, I think. And why would it, so why would it be wrong to be angry? What's the problem with it? Not trying to counteract it. Like, why is it harmful? Yep. Planting seeds.
It's a strive out of good karma.
Yep.
It's like a inherently wrong view of reality.
Right. Yeah. Pretty much always, you know, maybe a few exceptions, it would be based on wrong view. Yeah. I think the only time it's acceptable in Buddhism, if I'm remembering correctly, to have anger is towards our mental afflictions. Yeah.
And also it's hard to be compassionate when you're enjoying being angry.
Yeah.
You're not in a space of love and compassion.
Right. It shuts off everything else. You don't have access to other ways of thinking or seeing things. Yeah, it's just really destructive. I think it feels crappy. Have you guys ever felt like that you enjoyed it?
Yes.
I mean, maybe I have, but thinking about it right now, I'm like, I don't like the way it feels.
For me, it hasn't been like an outward enjoyment, but like there's like it's like the quality of it or something is like, oh yeah, I'm miserable and I'm gonna keep being miserable about it.
I'll show them. Yeah.
or a time when I felt like I was justified to be angry, so mm-hmm. It was like it felt good, you know, it was like feeling powerful to mm-hmm. be angry about the situation because it's justified.
Yeah, and there's
which
a weird,
isn't,
yeah. Yeah, there's a weird thing with that too because it's almost like if you're not getting angry, then it's okay what the other person's doing or something like that. Which, yeah, which isn't what it is because that's a wrong view too. You know, by getting angry, we're just planting the seeds for more anger. We're not going to change the situation in the present or somehow make some negative thing that someone did okay or seemingly negative. That's coming from the past, whatever's coming up right now. Then we're planting seeds for the future. So when we're in that moment where the anger is coming up or like we feel like we're supposed to be angry about something or, you know, people would judge us or give us a hard time if we weren't. Because I've been in situations like that too. Or where people say, are you just going to let people walk all over you? And basically, yeah. Right now, that's what I'm going to do, is what it comes down to. That's not what you're doing, but, you know, if that's their definition of it, then, yeah, that's what's happening. Because with the understanding of karma, of seeds we're planting, and that we can plant anything for our future, any of the angry seeds that we're planting are just going to come back as someone scary in our life or more anger in ourselves. Basically something unpleasant and a lot bigger than the present unpleasant thing that's coming up. Okay.
Okay.
go through a few more and then we'll take a break. Okay, so these are against the perfection of joyous effort. So they're planting the opposite seeds. For 21, say Nyankar. Duchir Kornam Du.
Duchir Kornam Du.
Okay. So this one is to gather a group of students because you're attached to gain or admiration. So Geshe Michael says one of the tests of this is when you hear other teachers have a lot of students and you're jealous, then you know you have this. So if you don't have this motivation, if you're not trying to gather a group of students, I don't know if this is just for, it sounds like it's just for teaching, like in a formal class. But maybe it could be like a study group or something like that, or if you go out concentric circles, just being attached to, I don't know, having like, yeah, like people knowing who you are, having a lot of friends, people liking you, that sort of thing. Anything to do with admiration or gain in that way, because you want, I don't know what you would want from people.
Would it be like a motivation to want to be liked by people? So you're like trying to.
So you'd get something from them, I think.
Yeah.
So like maybe you get.
Even though it seems subtle to me, it seems very subtle where it's like we all want to be liked, but is that like a concentric circle of that?
I think it might be, like, just for, but it'd need to be, like, you know, you're just trying to, like, gather a group of people around you because you want to be popular or something, because you want something from them. You want, like, their admiration. You want presents from them on your birthday or I don't know what. But it'd have to be some sort of afflictive emotion. I think that'd be kind of like a kind of far out concentric circle. But the main thing would be you don't want to, as a teacher, you don't want to help students. You don't want to teach them anything. You just want attention from them, or you just want offerings or gifts, or I think of like in high school, you know, like I can't think of anyone in my high school particularly, but you know the stereotype where there's like the mean girls who just use people and want them to be part of their pack for some reason, you know, like just to, so that they have people following them and that sort of thing. That's what I think of here too. And then, okay, number 22, say Lelo Lasok.
Lelo Lasok.
Sell me Jay.
Sell me Jay.
Okay, so this is not trying to stop your laziness, etc. So this is like when you're just getting into laying around and doing nothing all the time and not trying to stop yourself from doing that. It doesn't mean that you don't rest or relax after you've had like a hard week or you don't go on a vacation or something like that. But it means it's kind of like when it gets to be kind of like in a sick way where you're just like a blob laying around all the time. So, the exceptions would be recharging from work or travel. And relaxing in general is okay, but like, I think most of us know when it crosses the line, and you're just being, like, completely lazy. And then number 23, say Chakpe Dremoy. Tamla 10. This one I think is a really hard one. All of them are hard, but this is very prevalent, I think, in our culture. Frivolous talk about sex, crime, politics, etc. I mean, for the most part, that's what everyone talks about all the time. You know, unless maybe you're at the Dharma Center, and sometimes that's what we're talking about here too, but it's like everything on TV just about every reality show, mostly all the news. So it's interesting too, because Geshe Michael talks about how it can be really boring at first to not do this, because we're so attached to it and so used to doing it. Because we're attached to gossiping and idle speech. And he said that the way to do this is to grow and remember your bodhicitta and let that fill in the boredom when it comes. So let that bodhicitta and the wish to, you know, that everyone was out of the suffering, including myself, and I'm going to do it so that I can help everyone do it as well. Letting that feeling fill in that boredom, or I've felt this a lot of times in conversation too. So it's really most of what we read in newspapers and magazines. So if it's a point of information, just find out about it quickly and succinctly and then leave it alone. But if it's none, but it's if it's one of those lurid headlines and you're attracted, like super attracted to it, like about Kim Kardashian or something like that, then just leave it alone. It's probably pretty useless. Like, why do I need to know about, I tried to look at this article today about, there was like controversy with Kim Kardashian's India Vogue cover. And it didn't load right, so I didn't get to see it. But, like, what is the point of needing to see that? So it's completely frivolous. So the exceptions are if you're completely mindful about frivolous talk, which is, I think, very difficult to do because it's really tempting. You have a sharp, focused mind while engaging in order to get necessary information, and then that's it. The mindless talk that masquerades as dharma is the worst, like talking about different teachers or different centers, checking your motivation, like what is the point? Why talk about it? Because it's almost gossiping. It's like, what are they doing over there? What teachers do they have? How many members do they have in their sangha? That sort of thing. Like, what's the point of it? So, I like this part, though, too. You don't break it if you're hanging in the conversation to look for an opportunity to turn it to something meaningful. So, if you're, you know, if someone's talking to you and maybe they're talking about the news headlines, the latest thing with President Trump, with what is it, like Jared Kushner, I think, who's his son-in-law, his security clearance, he was like never cleared to have top secret security. So if someone's talking to you about that and you're hanging in there like looking for a way to turn it to something virtuous, then you're not breaking the vow. And also, as we've studied before, if it's not mindless talk, if you're talking about something that someone else is really interested in and excited about, and you know, it's out of kindness. Like, you're having a conversation with them because you know it's something that they want to talk about. Doesn't mean that you get sucked into the gossipy part, but it's kind of like you're making them comfortable. You're making conversation with them. You're talking about something that maybe you have no interest in just because you know that they do. So at that point, it's not frivolous because it's a kindness to the other person. And I don't feel like I can really put my finger on why. But Geshe Michael was saying he didn't read a newspaper for a year when he went to India, and he didn't miss anything. And I check in with the news here and there just because I think it might be useful, maybe when I'm teaching or studying or with connecting with people. But it's barely ever come up, and I really have like no interest in the news at all. And there's like, I know a lot of people who think it's so important to know everything that's going on. And I think there's a happy medium. I mean, it's just, for me, I've just never been interested. It just wasn't my thing, you know. For some people, it is. And so I think there's a medium place between me, I have like zero interest, and someone who has to know everything. So just knowing, like we were saying before, just getting in and getting details on something and getting out. On something that's maybe important that you're going to be able to help somebody with. Maybe in conversation, to start a conversation with someone that you wouldn't normally be able to. Like at a coffee shop or grocery store or, you know, something like that. But out of some motivation other than, look how terrible everything is and the world's falling apart. Or, you know, I remember Ami saying, and this one I found really helpful, is when you're looking at the headlines, you look at it as the cries of the world. Like, instead of getting overwhelmed and feeling hopeless, like, I can't do anything about this, you look at it and you think, this is why I'm setting this path. There's all of this suffering, and these people are calling out. They're waiting for me to reach enlightenment so that I can help them. So, you know, flipping it like that can be useful. But just looking at it article after article, I don't know the point of needing to know all those details. Especially, you know, like we don't have that much free time. So if you can judge for yourself, if there's like some really helpful information that you're getting out of reading all the news articles or different posts on Facebook, then doing it. And if not, then maybe spending your time doing something else. So it's up to each one of us in our own practice. I'm more attracted to like looking at like fashion online or something like that. So that would be like my thing. What would be the point? What's the point of looking at that all the time? So it's individual though, because for me, looking at fashion online, sometimes it's really exciting to me. So it gets like my energy lifted, and I feel like more creative and that sort of thing, as opposed to looking online and then at a fashion website like Harper's Bazaar, which is one I really like, and just reading all about like the celebrity gossip. So it's kind of sticky because we're online all the time and we're surrounded by magazines and newspapers and news, you know, on TV or the radio or wherever we hear it. So it's kind of protecting ourselves too, because I haven't completely experienced this, but apparently when you go into deeper retreat, then like everything that you've put in your mind starts to come out. So like all of the commercials, all of the crappy movies that we've seen, the TV shows, all those things start to come out. And for me, TV shows do that for sure. I'll be thinking about, you know, something that happened in The Good Wife or something like that. So being mindful of what we're putting into our mind. Okay, let's see if there's anything else on that one. And our mind only functions well for a brief period of time, so not wasting the small window of opportunity that we have. And it, not just for a brief period of time, for a brief period of time, and then also there's only brief periods of time within that brief period of time where we actually have free time or a choice, you know. Like we can practice through our whole life, through work, through everything that we're doing. But then there's those little times where we have a choice of what to input. Like maybe Dharma or meditation or whatever is useful at the time. All right. And basically we have a once in a million chance in this life. And if Buddhism is correct, our mind after this life will revert to something really low. It's not the case that we will automatically go back to a human life. So we have to take advantage of the time that we have here and now and not waste it. So before we open a book or look at another posting online or open a magazine, thinking, is this going to teach me directly a method to escape suffering and death? So if we have a chance to spend an hour and we're not exhausted, which sometimes we are, then pick up something that'll show you how to reach enlightenment. That'll be useful. And you get the, I think we probably all know that the experiential difference between looking at something that's going to help us get there and something that's not. Because otherwise we wouldn't be interested in this if we didn't know that. So I always feel better if I have the energy. If I decide to, usually I'll listen to teaching. After looking at the computer all day, I don't really want to be reading more. So usually I'll listen to a teaching. And sometimes doing like an extra meditation, but it's not always an option if it's after a long day and you're really tired. Okay. Why don't we take a break? Okay. Okay, so now these are against the perfection of concentration. So say Ting Nen Zi Gi.
Ting Nen Zi Gi.
Dun Mi Sok.
Dun Mi Sok.
Okay, so this one is failing to seek the meaning of single-pointed concentration. So an example of this is someone else is teaching about how to achieve single-pointed concentration and you don't go out of a bad motivation. You're too proud to go. It's one of your fellow students teaching. You don't want to. Exceptions are you doubt that they're teaching correctly. You're already a master. Or you're sick. So we all know this, but to see emptiness directly, we have to reach the equivalent of the first form realm. And if we don't meditate for at least an hour a day, we're not going to reach that. And so it's really important, the first level of the form realm. So whenever we get a chance to learn it properly, we have to go and we have to do it. It's basically just a level in your meditation. Yeah.
Is that the one where, like, you did the lines across the whiteboard and then the gaps and patching gaps and that place?
I think it's past those.
But that's, like, the levels, is that the same? Or is it different?
I think those are going to your mind, which can go like up and down in levels.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to be able to put your mind at a certain level in order to reach the form realm,
okay,
which is where you can see emptiness directly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that your mind would necessarily be able to be there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe at that point your meditation so stable that you would just stay at that level, and I don't know, I would think it'd have to be at least level 9 to be able to reach that, but I don't know for sure. I don't know how it correlates in that way. Okay, and number 25, say Samtan Dripa.
Samtan Dripa.
Pong Mije.
Pong Mije.
This is failing to remove the obstacles to meditation. So these aren't just obstacles to meditation, but they're obstacles to clear thinking in general. So a really good habit to get into is all the time working on your mind, keeping it bright, keeping it clear, not letting yourself just like space out and be dull, because you'll get in the habit and then that's what you'll do in your meditation. So keeping your mind clear and bright whenever you can. And I've been practicing that, I don't know, maybe like 6 months or something like that. And it makes a big difference in meditation. Because I didn't even notice. I would kind of like just space out. I don't know why, maybe just laziness or it was just a habit. And once I was more diligent and I stopped doing that, which I kind of had to drag myself out of it sometimes, it really helped my meditation a lot too.
Can you give, like, an example of, like, in daily life, like, when it was coming up for you?
It'd be, like, when I was driving.
Okay.
I would just, like, sit there and my mind would be dull and I'd kind of, like, space out. Like, my eyes would space out. And then my mind would just be, like,
yeah,
blah. Mm-hmm. And so I would actively bring my mind back and pay attention to what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I mostly remember it happening, is driving.
Like meetings, or teaching sometimes about the day and like.
Just like not feeling like it.
Yeah, or like not like trying to listen, just being here, but not.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a, especially in class, it's a waste of an opportunity,
mm-hmm,
and it's just a habit. That's what I've found about drowsiness and dullness. Yeah, it helps if I get more sleep, but most of it is a habit. Like, sometimes I don't get enough sleep, and my mind's super bright and clear. So it's not always related to that. A lot of times it's just the effort to clear your mind, as opposed to letting it just be, you know, like a blob and spaced out. And and it's not, it doesn't really feel that good either for it to be spaced out and kind of heavy.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're trying over and over to bring it back, a lot of times we're able to do it. And then it, even in the moment, it feels a lot better to have like a brighter mind than to just let ourselves space out. It's not a pleasant feeling usually. It's kind of just like blah, you know? Okay. So these obstacles will disturb our concentration at work and also when talking to people. So just throughout our whole life. And Geshe Michael says these are always mistranslated. People don't read the commentaries and the words don't mean what they usually do in this instance. So the first one, the five obstacles to meditation. First one say, Gugi. Second is Nusam. Mukni. Dupaladumpa. And Tesom. All right, so the first one, Gugi, is to be wild, for the mind to flip around from object to object in a restless way. I'm sure if your mind's anything like mine, you're used to this, especially when I'm at work, because I'm on Outlook, I'm in like a few PDFs, I'm online, notifications come up, I look at my phone, it's like it's a lot of stuff going on. And then I'm like flipping back and forth. So in that sense, you can start to make a decision like, I'm staying here for 5 minutes. And then if something comes up, you're not just drawn to it. You decide, okay, I'm going and looking at this. And then when you're done with that, you decide where you're going next. Instead of just being like drawn or ordered around by every notification that comes up or everything that's flashing or something like that. There's so much stimulation. It's amazing our minds can focus at all. I don't know if this applies here. But I really like the story that David Drabble told on Monday, where he said that, you know, you're paying attention to what you're doing. So you go to lunch with a friend, and it's like your mind's so jumpy. It would be as though, you know, some interesting person walks by, and you just get up and leave and go walk with that interesting person. As opposed to keeping your mind where it is. And we do that anyways, like our mind's leaving, and we look at that person and we stop paying attention. But in some sense, it's like that. So maybe thinking of that example when we have those times where we think we're multitasking, but we're really just being driven by whatever notification's coming up. We're not making any choice and we're not disciplining our mind at all. We're just being like going from this to this to this to this. I think it's a really hard one. It helps me if I decide I'm staying with something for a certain amount of time. And then today I decided I'm only checking my phone like from now, next 45 minutes I'm not looking at it. Next half hour I'm not looking. Like, you know, giving yourself some space. Because it's a huge obstacle to meditation. It'll completely mess up our meditation. It's basically in meditation, what this is like is we're missing things. We're thinking about people, people we knew, decisions we made. In meditation, that's what this looks like. You're wandering into the past. You're missing things. If you're in meditation, you're thinking about your friends, you're thinking about your job. The mind's just flipping from thing to thing. The second one, Nusam, is bad thoughts. And these can really destroy your meditation. I was outside meditating today at work, and I know there's this one lady, I think she's new, and she comes up and she smokes in the non-smoking area. And so when I'm meditating, I smell all the smoke, and I'm like, you're not supposed to smoke here. And so that basically ruined my whole afternoon meditation because I was so drawn to it and I kept trying to come back and come back And then finally she left, and I was like, I'm going to pull the sign right over to where she was sitting when I leave, and I completely forgot. Because it didn't even matter that much. It's just it comes up in meditation, and it feels so important. So that was like anger, agitation, irritation that ruined the meditation. It probably all of us have had some experience of that one. So it's any bad thought about a person. And Geshe Michael tells this story. There was this, I think he was a monk, and the main thing that he remembered about his whole 3-year retreat was that there was this guy that was in retreat that he didn't like. And the guy didn't like him either. And he used to write notes to him saying, like, don't look at me like that. And that sort of thing. And that's what he remembers from his retreat. So, like we were saying before, retreat amplifies the thoughts for good or bad. So remember that when you're in your meditation, and I need to do this too, for sure, that it amplifies all of these things. So when you're in meditation, something seems so important and you have to think about it. It's not. It's just an affliction. It's just a distraction coming up. It doesn't matter. You can come back to it if it's that important after your meditation. And usually it's not. Usually we completely forget about it. But it's like dragged our mind off and we're somewhere totally else. Somewhere else. We're not even really meditating anymore. But the good thing is that the good thoughts strengthen too. So if we're focusing on, you know, when the good thoughts come up in meditation, they're a lot stronger too. So both are true. And sometimes those good thoughts like drag you off as well. Okay, the third one, mukni, is foggy mindedness, a dull mind or drowsiness. And you get this one can be really dangerous because you get this when you think you're meditating really well, but you're actually just dull and foggy. You're not focused, but you're sitting really nicely and your mind's like, blah. So it's like, it doesn't feel clear or crisp or focused completely. It's just a little bit out of focus. Which one of the major dangers of meditation is to hang out there because you're not making any progress. So to really be on top of your meditation when you're in there, and don't waste that time because you're in there doing your meditation. You might as well do it and really like grab hold of it, you know, without getting too tense. So it's like if you're tired from work and you try to meditate, or if you're too tired from work all the time, then maybe needing to rethink your schedule. And he says again in this class, if we can't meditate clearly for about an hour, then we won't see emptiness directly. And all of us have the capability to do that. We just have to arrange our lives in the right way and get to the, you know, work up to that amount of time if we're not there already. And in my experience, it takes a while to work up to that amount of time. I think a long time, unless you're doing lots of retreats, that helps too. So if we're in that foggy mindedness, what we do is, if it's really severe and you can't pull yourself out of it, then you get up and you splash water on your face, or when you're seated, you think about His Holiness the Dalai Lama or your teacher or someone who really brightens your mind. And you don't just give in to it over and over, because then you're just habituating yourself to dullness. Dupa la Dumpa is attraction for sense objects, food, smells, etc. Sounds are really difficult in meditation too. So any kind, meditation is a function of the mind. It's all internal. It's all in the mind. Jade Tsongkhapa denies that meditation is anything else. So basically, you want to be going inward and not outward to all of the sounds or smells or, you know, people talking. It's good to even, like, turn your heater down when you're meditating or turn it off if it doesn't get too cold, so there's not that sound bothering you every moment, too. And it's not, meditation's not focusing on a physical object. It's not listening to music. I've heard a lot of people say that. Let's see. I think we gotta get moving. So basically, when that happens, you just catch your mind and bring it right back. When you've grabbed onto something, you just release, or you just pull your mind right back. It doesn't have to be a big deal. It doesn't have to, you don't have to think about how you got off the object, then you're just off the object longer. You just come back right away. And if you're completely shanghaied, like Doug talks about, then you can, you know, you maybe need a little more intense bringing back, like the 4 R's, where you release and then, I think he kind of changed them, but you release and then you relax. No, you release, you return. I don't even remember, I haven't been doing them.
Relax, rejoice.
Relax, rejoice.
Return, relax.
Release.
Yeah, release, relax, rejoice, return.
Rejoice, return. And then he changed it to like where you recollect, you remember the purpose of your meditation. Mm-hmm. That one was, that's really helpful actually. I find that one really helpful. Like I'm here to reach shamatha, and then like your meditation gets really bright. Okay. Next one, tesom, is being indecisive and not choosing to do important things. So if you don't try to stop these, even just struggling a little bit against them during meditation, you're breaking the vow. This last one, it doesn't refer to critical doubt. The Buddha said that you must be critical. So you test everything out, and then, so you actually take the time to test everything out. You're not lazy about it and just say, I don't know about that, and then you just push it aside. You take the time to test it, and you make yourself do it, and then you reach some conclusion about it. So it's like being too lazy to decide. Am I going to meditate? Am I not? Am I going to stop this bad habit? Am I not? It's just like, am I going to figure out if karma's true or not? It's just not doing those things, just putting them off. And usually it doesn't take that much effort to come to a conclusion on them. It just takes a little bit of discipline, especially when we've had so many classes on it too. And you all have like a lot of knowledge and, you know, supporting knowledge to help with it. And so this ruins our meditation doing that. Oh, I really like this meditation. I forgot about it. So if we have a problem with sense desires, it's a good meditation to do where you see your body rotting or disintegrating, everyone else around you, like the whole building, all of planet Earth. It's a really cool meditation. I really like it. I haven't done it in so long. we have 26 on here too? Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So 26 is to consider the pleasant feeling of meditation an important personal attainment in and of itself, as though that's the goal, is the pleasant feeling. And usually it's just a distraction. Unless we're already enlightened, we want to keep going and going and pushing through, so not to get too comfortable in that place, which also, I think, kind of lends itself to subtle dullness, just hanging out there. So knowing that these things come up and they're great and they're pleasurable, but not to get distracted and think that that's the goal. The goal's a lot better than that. Okay. We're doing good. Any questions so far? They're pretty straightforward. I don't think they always are when they come up in our lives, but it's kind of hard to think of those, all those possibilities when we're just looking at the vows. Okay, number 27. These last ones are against the perfection of wisdom. To reject Hinayana by saying that bodhisattvas shouldn't study, listen to, learn, or follow Hinayana teachings. And I don't think that any of us would say that after going through these courses and studying enough. So this is different from the primary vow in that it isn't a rejection of the whole system. It's only a rejection of it for bodhisattvas. So, the Hinayana teachings, we study those. We've studied them in these courses. We'll study them more. They're an important part of the whole path. And they're amazing, too. They might not be what we would call the ultimate truth, but they're all taught by the Buddha. And we walk that path probably just as much as we walk the Mahayana path. Number 28 is to devote yourself to Hinayana at the expense of your Mahayana practices. So what would that look? What do you think that would look like? Mm-hmm. And maybe deciding to go for that instead of full enlightenment and for the sake of others.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. maybe deciding to go to Hinayana classes instead of Mahayana classes, like on a continual basis. Any other ideas?
Maybe like guru devotion? Who you are making offerings to and like...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Number 29, to make efforts in non-Buddhist teachings. And this is excessively to the point where you're detracting from your Mahayana pursuits. And that could be what we were talking about earlier with like going on Facebook and just mindlessly looking at all the posts for an hour, something like that. Or because that could also be a Mahayana practice if you're doing it with the right motivation. So anything can be just about... if you have the right motivation. And also anything could not be like sitting in this class could not be potentially. So it's all to do with what's happening in our mind and our motivation, which is partly why the Buddha says to never judge another, because you don't really know what's happening in their mind. You don't really know who they are. It's easy to judge them, just like the monks did in the monastery with Master Shantideva. And he's turned out to be a master. So there's really not enough time in your life to squander it on things that don't work. And I don't know if all of you feel this already, but I feel like the older I get, I have less and less time. It really feels like that. And all of the teachings that I've heard for years where Ami has been saying, you know, you barely have any time. And I'm like, I have time. but I don't know if the teachings sink in more or if it's getting older or what it is, but I realize more and more I don't have much time at all. Like, my day is full with work, and then I have maybe a few hours, if I'm lucky, where I get to go to class and hopefully be able to pay attention and study. And, you know, I do my meditation in the morning, so try to, like, stack it all in there, but there's really not much time. And then on the flip side, there's all the time if you can practice all the time. If, you know, if the practice is in your mind all the time, then there is a lot of time. But in a more mundane sense, there's really not, between eating, sleeping, showering, preparing food, working. It's just like it fills up so quickly. And we've mostly, and I mean, I think we've all done this, but we have to just pick one path and go with it fully because of that too. Partly because picking and choosing isn't going to work. We have to go with one, whatever it is that we decide. But also we just don't have the time. Like, I don't have the time to learn all different... I don't have time to learn Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. I don't have the time. Even if I wanted to, I wouldn't have the time. I only have the time to learn one really well. Even if you make efforts to be attracted, so basically, you look into Hinayana or other religious systems and you get completely sucked in. My sense, and I don't know for sure, but this is my thought. It's not that you think... It's to have such an attraction, like I just said, where you get sucked into it. It's not just that you think something's interesting or is useful and helpful, because most of the world, the big world religions, are extremely helpful for people. And, you know, like, I feel attraction just to all religion in general, but I don't think that's what it's saying. Saying more like you look into it and then you get sucked into these other things instead of the path that you're walking on. So you're kind of just wasting time. You're getting diverted. Okay, 31. Oh my gosh. To give up Mahayana. Did I list it on there? No. Okay. So there's four ways of doing it. By saying this particular part of the subject isn't correct or important. Second, this part isn't written so well. The third, the author isn't that good. And then the fourth is this isn't much benefit for living beings. And this goes back to the advice of if something doesn't speak to us or if it doesn't make sense to us, then we don't say that it's not true. We just say, I don't know about this right now. I'm going to shelve it. I'm going to come back to it. I can't imagine any of us really doing this. But the way I could see it coming up is maybe if someone comes to class and they're not attracted to a certain subject, you know, saying, oh, it's not that important, just do this. Something along those lines. You know, where you can instead give the advice. There's, you know, there's definitely things that come up that are more difficult to learn than others. And you just shelve it. Go on to something that's, like, attractive right now and then come back to it. Thirty-two, praising yourself or criticizing others. So this one's out of anger, pride, or self-cherishing. And the root vow is broken out of desire. So the exceptions are disproving harmful views or to teach a lesson. Thirty-three, we only have two more. Not going to a Dharma talk out of laziness or pride. And I think I'd say probably the longer you study and when the people you're studying with are starting to teach, this can come up more. Because, you know, maybe it's one of someone you've studied with for a while, you're like, I don't feel like going, you know, like they're not Geshe Sotram or they're not Lamami or something like that, you know, like there's some pride in there. Like they're teaching and I'm going to go to their class, like, you know, like I'm too good to go to their class type feeling.
I feel like I can't get enough energy to pay attention and all of this.
Yeah, I think it's a hard one to judge because sometimes I feel like that too, and I've kind of erred on the side of I just always go no matter what, but I don't think that that's always helpful. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of something that you just have to be able to judge and see, like, no, I'm really exhausted and I need to rest, as opposed to kind of like I just don't feel like it. It's too much effort or something. But I think that's a hard one. I've found it difficult because it's not always helpful. If you're really overtired and then, you know, you're not going to sleep well or be able to prepare for the next day or something like that. So, I don't know. That one's kind of hard. But there are exceptions. One is if you're sick or you're unable to go. I mean, this one's kind of obvious, but you're unaware of the class. you're already a master of the subject. You suspect it's inaccurately taught. You're in deep retreat and you can't break it. Or if it might upset your regular Dharma teacher. I don't quite understand that last one. You don't have to go if it might upset your regular Dharma teacher.
Like you're going to a different teacher?
I don't know. not going to a Dharma talk out of laziness or pride. Yeah, I don't really get that last one. Because your teacher should want you to be studying. Okay. And then number 34. To put down your Dharma teacher by not seeing them as a Buddha. To speak badly about them. To be more interested in the presentation than the content. So that one is pretty big. To put down your Dharma teacher by not seeing them as a Buddha. I think that's a tall order. So trying to practice that all the time. The way that I start to practice it is just by visualizing them that way whenever they're sitting at their teaching, trying to visualize them as a Buddha. Because why? Why would you want to do that? Because then you're getting teachings from a Buddha. And it's a lot more powerful for you. Like the person teaching, your teacher, they might be a Buddha, they might not. So if they're not, they're not going to know how you're seeing them anyways. You know, so it's not going to make much of a difference to them. And if they are a Buddha, they're going to be rejoicing that you're practicing that. But it's not like they need you to see them as a Buddha, they're already a Buddha. So it's really for your own growth and to start seeing the world as more magical. As opposed to like, oh, there's just this person up here teaching who's, you know, been teaching me for like 10 years and they're just teaching me the Dharma. Which is, if you go through the proof of it, it's really amazing. To have someone doing that for, like, Ami has been teaching me Dharma for, like, 10 years. Over and over and over. Class after class after class. How could that be a normal person who would do that? And who knows all those teachings, who has, like, the depth of knowledge, who takes the time, who wants to devote their life to doing that. So thinking through the reasons why they could be a Buddha, as opposed to just see, because they have to come to us in a form that we can relate to. So if our teacher walked in as a Buddha, we wouldn't have the seats to see them. We probably wouldn't even see them at all. They could be here right now sitting with us, and we have no idea because we don't have the karmic seats for that. And then if they come too low as, you know, like a dog or something, we're not going to... Or even a child, we're not going to listen to them. You know, like a dog, we're not even going to understand what they're saying. But they come exactly at the level that's good for us. It's all for us. It's not because they couldn't come some other way. And there's, I believe it's in, I think it's in the Lam Rim Chenmo. That go through, there's like proofs of why your teacher is a Buddha. And it's really, really helpful to read. It just gives all of the reasons. And like a good number of reasons and like lists in Buddhism, some of them don't really make much sense to me. I'm like, why is that in there? But somehow reading them all together, it just adds up and helps to get a sense of, oh yeah, this person who's been teaching me for so long, they really could be a Buddha based on what the Buddha taught. You know, he said that's how he would come in the days of degeneration, which is what we're in, is as the masters or the teachers. So practicing seeing whoever you can that way is a really helpful practice for you. And no one else knows what you're doing. You know, you have your own space in your mind. So just trying it out and seeing what it does, seeing how it affects your experience, if it changes things, what it feels like, as opposed to you know, even just thinking, like, when Ryan's teaching, like, oh, it's just Ryan. So it's like when someone starts teaching for us, they take on like a different, unless we can see them all the time like that. But when they start teaching, they're the Buddha, like telling us the words of wisdom. So introducing like some magic, not in the way, you know, like cheap tricks or something like that, but. To speak badly about them, or to be more interested in presentation than the content, which I think can be a real danger. You're more interested if somebody is really entertaining, or which is really helpful as, you know, as a student, because it keeps you engaged and interested. So that's a really helpful thing to have. But kind of like more interested in the entertainment factor, or what the person looks like as opposed to what they're saying or their knowledge. To speak badly about them. We have the opportunity to do these because we're around a lot of teachers and teachings. So to be really careful not to say anything bad about just any teachers in general, to keep ourselves safe. You know, you could extrapolate it and just say not speaking badly about anybody. But at least starting with that, so you don't get anywhere near this one.
Would that be include
teachers? That wouldn't be the vow, but it would be concentric circles, because it's a Dharma teacher. So unless you see them as a Dharma teacher, then it would include them. But it would be a good practice to try.
I feel like if you really look pretty much everyone's teaching on the level of Dharma.
Totally. So we just start where we can too. But if you can go to that place, then that's a great place to go to. To start to look for the teachings that everyone's giving, then all day is basically a Dharma teaching or useful. Okay.
Sashi
Puki Chukshing Meito Tram. Rira Ling Shi Nyan De Gyan Padi Sangye Shing Du Mik Te Uar Gi Chokun Am Dak Shing La Chupar Shok Yidam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Nirya Tayami
Gewa
Di Gewa Kun Sunam yeshe sok sok shi. Sunam yeshe le jun wei. Tampa kuni to par shok.